It is Saturday, April 18th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news and a discussion with an internet architect about the data path from your home to the rest of the world. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today we're speaking with Aaron Hughes, an internet architect, about the structure of the internet, from your home to the actual backbone. We'll be talking about how that all works. You can ask us questions about the topic in the second half. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org right now to send us an email, participate in our forums, and I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. You can also do a new thing with us. We have a chat going on the entire time of the show. So what you do is go to geekspeak.org, click on today's show date, which is the 18th of April, and on the left-hand side it says Geek Chat, and you can chat with us and add information, and Ben's watching it the whole time. Very cool stuff. It's a love-hate relationship. Love your cars, hate it when they break. You'll love the car guys and hate to miss them. And Click and Clack give their advice on things automotive every Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday morning at 9 right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Great Infusions Coffee Beanery and Espresso Machinery. Showroom offering artisans coffees, coffee makers, and specializing in home espresso machines, parts, and repairs. Located at 317 Potrero Street on the corner of River Street in Santa Cruz, or online at www.greatinfusions.com. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks. Ben Jaffe, a freelance media guy.
Good morning.
Miles Elam, student programmer and political junkie.
Good morning.
Good morning, Miles. And Al Luckow, he's a new media architect.
Hello, everybody.
We also have Aaron Hughes in the air the entire time while we're doing Geek News. And Aaron, if you want to participate, please feel free to do so.
It will do. Good morning.
All right. Wow, nice voice. All right, let's start with Miles Elam for the Geek News.
Well, we have a new CTO.
Miles, what's a CTO?
Chief Technology Officer.
Although for GeekSpeak?
Not for GeekSpeak. Actually, we already have one. We're all kind of sharing the title. But this is not even for our company. This is for the United States.
America?
Yes. Is a new, I believe, cabinet-level position.
Yeah, I think that's true. I remember when you first told me about that in the Obama election campaign, that he was going to have a CTO. It seemed like a very intelligent thing to do.
And there's been some question about it. Some folks in Silicon Valley were upset that he wasn't from the Silicon Valley. He did not have a history in terms of tech startups and the like. But what he does have
which
is...
Which means he hasn't watched a dot-bomb.
<Go on. laughs> But what it does mean is he's coming from his role as the effective CTO of Commonwealth of Virginia, the state of Virginia. And so he has a lot of knowledge with regard to government and bureaucracy and bringing technology into that.
And I'm assuming he does have a technology background, like he knows how things work to some degree?
That one, from what I can tell, he's not necessarily someone that you would consider a tech guy.
Okay. He's not a geek.
But at the same time, if you watch, we have his show linked up on our site, or we will soon. Or not his show, but a
video cast of him or something?
Yeah, a keynote that he gave recently that he knows what he's talking about. He's
What's
not
his name?
Just BSing his way through it.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Anish Chopra.
Okay. So you were listening to the video on the ride, and Ben was driving and I was in the front, but you were watching a video of him kind of addressing some of these concerns, his keynote. What are some of the things that you thought were interesting?
One was the fact that to put in new textbooks, for example, like, say, a new physics textbook, one of the things they were talking about was, okay, this year we get together the people that would be involved in making the textbook, and then we start planning, making a plan for what we're going to do with it next year, and then we actually start to execute that plan the year after that, and then we start actually publishing the year after that. So, you know, it looks out 2011, 2012 before you'd actually get a new physics textbook out mm-hmm. by the traditional means. Whereas what he did was put out a call to various folks in academia and said, hey, I want to make a new physics textbook. If you're interested in collaborating, you know, give us your information, try to put your stuff together. And he had dozens of responses from people ranging from 10th graders to people who are on physics faculty at various universities. Mm-hmm. And he had a particular member of physics faculty at Maryland, I believe, set up a system for peer review for all submissions.
Right.
And that textbook went into production beginning of this year.
How long did it take to do that? Was it the same cycle or was it a shorter period of time?
Much shorter. We're talking about in the time frame of months instead of
And
years.
I'm assuming, and because of the way you allow a group of people to do it, that peer review process and that system, you're actually producing an infrastructure for that to happen without having like a business model around it, a whole business.
Well, the idea here, at least this is one of the ways that people are looking at it, is that he's not having government say, okay, we're going to take care of all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's more of, okay, here's the ground rules. Go for it.
Yeah, yeah, good.
And when people come back with it, say, okay, does this fit the ground rules? Okay, let's.
Okay,
let's
what about, forward. I mean, the thing that I think always think about, people that work at public schools and stuff, the website addresses are, you know, .com, .gov. Or .ca.gov, right, is mm-hmm. normally for the California school system. They'll be somewhere in there. And I always think about that mail actually is hitting some local server at the school sometimes. I mean, the mess of that structure. Did you talk a little bit about that, the education data structure?
He didn't talk – individual schools, there's definitely an issue with regard to how regular they are.
Yeah.
The different school districts are going to have many times very different IT infrastructures. But one of the things he talked about wasn't necessarily about that. It was more to do with if you're testing for one of the things he brought up in the video was if you're testing for when performance seems to drop off. Apparently third mm-hmm. grade is this major issue. If you pass this third grade literacy or competency exam, it says statistically that you're going to do well later on. And if you mm-hmm. don't, statistically you're not going to do well. It's a major turning point there. And what to do about it. But they couldn't really collate that data with some of the other data like socioeconomic levels, where these people are coming from, because those are in different databases.
Right.
And there are good reasons for those databases to be separate. There are definitely privacy issues. And so those are some of the things he talked about, the government side of that.
So that whole system needs to be cleaned up a bit. It concerns me, though. I mean, I like the idea of someone smart being in charge of that. But at the same time, one of the things I heard in the video fragment that I was listening to from behind me was that he was talking about the idea that if you're in a healthcare plan and a person goes and gets a neonatal exam, and then there's actually a government package that will actually subsidize some part of your process.
Or we'll look at it starting from the first trimester. So
looking for the first trimester, but you never actually get that information until you're actually more along in the system. And if we had more analysis, we could predetermine that somebody would need that package. But then you're talking about dissecting and looking at people's private data.
Right,
and we're talking about government doing that.
Which also means that, yes, you were only catching the periphery, because one of the statements he says in there is, if you opt into it,
okay,
that you can have that information.
Well, I'm glad that there's somebody there looking at these points. I think they're really crucial, and thanks for keeping us informed about it.
Yeah, and
you can watch
whether you like him or not. I mean, that's the thing. We did post a video up. He does have keynote, so you can get a sense of what the guy is like before he was announced to be the CTO of the nation. So at the same time, and he has a track record that people can go back and look and see if this is what they're looking for or not.
Right,
get some feedback.
Thank you very much, Miles. Al.
Yes. Oh, just have to warn you, I found some neat things with cell phones, but I'm going to have to say the word telemicroscopy a couple times.
Okay, you did pretty well.
I generally only say it right once.
Okay, so what is telemicroscopy?
It sounds painful.
Yeah. It's, you know, basically, using creating a microscope out of a camera. But
oh, cool.
One thing it's kind of neat is I found this, there's this organization called the Richard C. Bloom Center for Developing Economies. And they research things that can help third world countries. And there's this particular project that's focusing on Africa and Asia. And it's basically a cell phone add-on that turns the cell phone into a little mini microscope. And so you clip it on the cell phone, and it allows you to take a picture of things and then send that picture to a hospital. I guess in these third world countries, they really don't have any of these. They don't have any kind of technology at all. They've just got nothing.
But phones.
But they all have cell phones with cameras.
So it's basically a large lens aperture that turns your – so it just gives you a magnification.
Yeah, and it says they have it going from 5 to 50. But they've got pictures of
50 times magnification.
Yeah, 50 times magnification. And they've got some pictures of what looks to be cells. So essentially they'll be able to go to these, remote areas, and they can take pictures of cells or lesions or things like that and then annotate them and then send them to
somebody else that can have more analysis about it with the computer system.
Which is, I think it's a really cool thing. I mean, it's sometimes I look at these things and I wonder if the cell phone is actually getting closer to a tricorder.
The Star Trek tool?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
What do you mean? It does a lot of stuff.
Well, camera phones do a lot of stuff?
Well, at some point we're going to have phones that are like tricorders. How close are they?
Well, not close at all. I mean, okay, let me just geek out for a moment and say that the tricorder is number one. It's Trekker from Star Trek, is number one, a sensing device, right? You can sense atmospheric conditions. You can sense chemical composition of rocks. You can scan people's bodies figure out their entire anatomy from just that. You can look at their DNA structure with a tricorder. I mean, like, it's kind of ridiculous, and it's very science fiction-y. This little, device that you can hold in your hand that can do pretty much anything you could possibly want. Cell phones are not... Yeah, cell phones can tell if something's red or green.
Well, imagine for a moment if Apple comes out with the eye implant and your sensing devices are your nose or your tongue or what something feels like.
Yeah, it would have your heart rate, but then you'd need an eye implant to be sensed.
Okay, Ben,
the tricorder
is a separate device. The ability to detect amounts of carbon monoxide or something, that's a small chip sensor. And we could theoretically put one in a phone.
Yeah, but so, I mean, how many
of the chips? Well, they get they get denser. They can do more sensing. I mean, have you seen the viral detection stuff that exists now? The chips that actually tell you what kind of virus you have. These things are a chip, and they do address. It's amazing what they can do. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily happening right now, but it could at some point.
But can the tricorder make a call?
And see?
No.
A tricorder can't be called after the thing on the chest.
You can interface it with a communicator. If you just put a communicator on the end of a tricorder, then there's your tricorder communicator device.
Miles,
you can send video with them, I think. I think that was in one episode.
You can create bombs
with them. Oh, my gosh. With tricorders. I mean, you can
Worf used a communicator to make a force field for a short period of time. That was pretty
cool. Yeah, I know. It's ridiculous. It's crazy.
That was just a communicator.
It's like you can't. No. Cell phones and tricorders, really?
Ben, stop. Now, you're saying that, look, we're having this new sensing technology, but it only does this one thing. It isn't like the thing that is projected for 400 years in the future.
Well, it's not 400 years in the future.
The Star Trek universe?
Well, it's between 200 and 500 years,
The emails come pouring in.
It's exactly 3,200.
We don't know, what the exact date is.
It depends on what kind of tricorder
Ben, what you're saying is basically...
There are several models of tricorder, right? And of course, the ones that that were in the original series look like... You know those circuit boxes
Ben,
you
need
build?
To shut up now.
They've got screws
really
and everything? Hey, Al started it.
Okay. It isn't like a tricorder.
Okay, Ben.
I'm all right.
What's your next news story? Thanks, Al, for the tricorder thing. Microscope.
Oh my God, that was fun. Okay.
You have the note here. It says Area 51.
Yes.
What are you talking about?
I can't tell you.
I'm scared now.
I can't tell you what I'm talking about. It's classified.
All right.
The end.
Okay,
no.
Next.
Okay. So in 2007, the CIA began declassifying. This particular program called the Oxcart program. It's been classified for 50 years, right? So back in the 60s, they were testing this this aircraft. It was this Mach 3 aircraft, right? It could go three times the speed of sound. And it was responsible for, we're now learning, a lot of the UFO sightings, like thousands of sightings. It says in the article, and you should read this article. It's a really great article by the LA Times. They interview three people who used to work at Area 51.
And it's available at geekspeak.org.
Yeah. I'll post it in a couple minutes. But yeah, they talk about basically all this stuff that they were not allowed to talk about for 50 years, right? And of course, eyewitness accounts are tend to be inaccurate, but they are saying some pretty interesting things. And they're saying that this aircraft is responsible probably for thousands of UFO sightings. It said that while one of the guy that they were interviewing, this guy named Slater was his name in the article, he says in all 2,850 Oxcart test flights were flown out of Area 51. That's out of Area 51 he was in charge. So you can just imagine how many UFO sightings this must have been responsible for. Commercial pilots would be flying and see this thing, you know, whiz by them up above and report these sightings to the FAA. And as they're flying past Area 51 in Nevada, they'd land in California and they'd get off the plane and be met by FBI agents who'd make them sign non-disclosure forms, you know, saying, like, don't talk about this. And, of course, not all of them kept their mouth shut.
But, so you're a pilot, you see something interesting, you call it in, and when you land, agents are there like, okay, you can't talk about this.
Yeah, you can't talk. You can't mention this to anyone.
Conspiracy.
That's very clever to keep the silence.
And you know, but you know,
Miles, your tinfoil hat's falling off.
If you get people to wear the tinfoil hats, if you get people to think, wow, the FBI must be, you know, dissecting UFO spacecraft in Area 51. That must have been a UFO or something, right?
It helps hide them.
It's in the best interest of the FBI to make people to perpetuate that myth, the UFO myth.
Yeah, that actually does bring up an interesting point. This is something from Neil deGrasse Tyson, actually, the astrophysicist.
Oh, I love that guy.
Yeah, he's great. Where he was saying, okay, someone calls in and says, I saw a UFO. And you say, oh, well, describe it. Well, it's kind of cylinder shaped, looked like alien technology, and it came from. Wait a second. You just said it was a UFO. It means it's unidentified. Now you're saying you know what it is, that it's an alien coming in. But you said it was unidentified. That's not a UFO.
Yeah, so UFO and doesn't mean
that's not a UFO. You're identifying.
That's mean IFO. That would be an IFO.
Internationally flying ship?
No,
identifiable
flying object.
All right.
Which we see all the time.
Thank you very much for that update.
I'm sure I know that this is an alien FO.
Right.
That's what it is, right?
Thank you very much for that update. Sure. Miles, your turn, sir.
So, the game Demigod by the publisher Starduck, had a massive piracy problem. Basically, they were going to release their new game, Demigod, and they but before the official launch date, a GameStop chain, the chain GameStop, started selling the game early. And they sold 18,000. Actually, no, I think it was the chain. My mistake. They sold 18,000 licenses to this game. However, 100,000 more showed up to the online server, than bought licenses. So obviously a huge amount of piracy. Then again, it was before the official launch date, so who knows how many of them weren't near a GameStop and simply got the game. And it flooded the server. The server ended up being just slowing to a crawl, a bad user experience, and you end up with a whole bunch of reviews online saying, hey, this game is, you know, not as responsive, it has some issues, but it was before the official launch date. And by the time the official launch date came around, they were actually able to hit the numbers and the performance numbers that they really wanted to get.
So the piracy actually damaged their reviews.
Well, see, there's the curious thing, is it also got a whole bunch of press.
Right.
That it wouldn't have already gotten. So it's going to be hard to... We're going to have to wait a little while before we see what the actual effects were. But this is one of the bigger stories with regard to piracy hitting it. Just like we have to see after the movie comes out what's going to happen to Wolverine Origins. That is that going to be hurt by the number of people who have seen it before the release date? Or is it going to be helped?
Right.
Or is it going to be neutral? So just another one, just another little chink adding to the piracy puzzle.
Arg.
Al, will you tell us about robots?
Oh, there's actually
what people are calling the most adorable robot experiment ever.
No. Tell us about the ones that are going to take over our lives.
I told you about those before.
Okay.
But they're drinking our blood and stuff.
Oh, yeah, that one.
Yeah.
That
converting it to energy. This one was an experiment by students at New York University, NYU.
Uh-huh.
The Tisch School of Arts.
That's where Dee Dee, one of our geeks, went.
Oh, she went to Tisch School, maybe she's involved in this. It says the student's name is Casey Kinzer, and this student created a little device called the Tweenbot. And it's just this little robot that's in a cardboard casing. It's got, a little smiley face on it, like two eyes and a smiley face. And it's just sort of made out of cardboard and two little red wheels. And all it does is drive forward. And it's got a little antenna on it with a flag that says, help me get to this place, And this is New York, okay? So they dropped this robot into the park in New York. Just to see what would happen, they thought it'd be stomped on or covered in graffiti or whatever. But in all the different places they put it, which was mostly parks, the robot ended up getting where it was going. And it completely relied on the kindness of strangers.
So all it did was go forward.
It just goes forward and people are like walking. There's videos of it on the site. And people are like walk around. They see this little robot. It's like not even a foot tall. And they're like, what the heck? And they look and they see it says on there. And they just pick it up and point it in the right direction. Or the robot gets stuck in the curb and it's like. And somebody walks up to it and looks at it and picks it up and drops it in the middle of the sidewalk, and then it keeps going. And in every case, the robot ended up getting to the place
that
it was going.
That's cool. Fantastic.
It's just funny.
I don't think being on general streets with cars would be a good idea for it.
No,
that's a social engineering solution as opposed to a technical engineering solution.
I don't
know
if that's a robot. That's more of just a... thing that moves forward.
Just a thing that moves forward, but it looks like a robot.
I mean,
you see the picture of it, you'd think
it's
a cute little robot-looking thing that moves forward.
And it's called the Tweenbot.
The Tweenbot, yeah.
So that it kind of raises images in my head of trying to explore adulthood, but not quite ready, a little bit awkward.
Yeah.
That's a really great name for that. It's something that moves from one point to another until it hits a keyframe where someone picks it up, turns it, and goes.
I didn't even think of tween in that sense. I thought of tween meaning like preteen.
It's another, it's all this Flash work.
No, that's a brilliant name.
Yeah.
Someone on that team uses Flash.
It is pretty cute. We put that link up there.
Oh, definitely.
Let people see this thing.
I'll get it up in just a second. There it is. All right, anyway, let's go on to the next story, last news story for the day, actually, and then we'll get on with our topic at hand. Ben, what's going on in space?
Well, we covered this before. NASA was holding an online contest to name one of the nodes, Node 3 at the International Space Station, and they had their choices. The four suggested options were Serenity, Legacy, Earthrise, and Venture, and then they also had write-in votes. Stephen Colbert popped on his television show one day and said, "Hey, everyone, write in my name." And so they got they got tons and tons of people who were all suggesting Colbert is the name for the node, right? And so
when you say the node, you're saying
one
like
it's a room in the
one
space
of the segments that's added on the space station.
Yeah, effectively it's a room, but they call it a node because it's space and everything has to have a different name. But
could have called it a pod.
Yeah, well, that'd be cool.
No, that means they'd be sued by Apple. Yeah.
Well, in any case, what ended up happening, NASA, of course, said in the conditions for the write-ins that they reserve the right to choose what they want.
They didn't choose Colbert.
So they got I don't know. I can't remember. The numbers were huge, though. It was more than twice the number of votes for Colbert as opposed to the highest voted suggested option. Well, anyway... So on Tuesday, on the Colbert Report, astronaut Sunita Williams announced on behalf of NASA that they've decided on a name for Node 3. And the node for the name for Node 3 will be called it'll be named Tranquility. But they actually named something. They said, we decided not to name it after Stephen Colbert. So, everyone is thinking, oh, NASA doesn't have a sense of humor. They instead decided to name a treadmill after Stephen Colbert.
So it's a treadmill.
So there's a treadmill on the International Space Station named the Colbert.
That's great.
Treadmill.
Far better than the Colbert toilet.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I just
which
found
was
that
a possibility,
hilarious.
Right? At one point, they were talking about naming him after the toilet on the space station.
Oh, that's great.
Because I mean, NASA. Does NASA have a sense of humor? I mean, apparently they do.
Thank you, Ben, for that.
Yeah.
Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. We are taking on-topic calls about internet infrastructure. If you want to join the conversation, please feel free to do so. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. And that's in the 831 area code, or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks today, Ben Jaffe, Miles Elam, and Al Lucko. Thanks for doing the news with us, guys.
Sure.
Always
sure.
A pleasure.
Thanks for your wonderful segues.
Yes.
Oh, it was really a pleasure today to do that, yeah. Okay, our guest, Aaron Hughes, is president and CTO of 6Connect, Inc., and senior technology leader with 15 years of experience in senior systems and network engineering and architecture, along with automation and technology strategies. He has a background in networking and systems automation with management-level experience with various U.S. agencies and internet service providers, which all boils down to he knows how the internet works. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So a couple weeks ago, we had a big outage of network traffic because a couple people or somebody cut some fiber lines throughout Silicon Valley, two points. And when that happened, I was, as I learned about it and called you and asked you about what was going on, I got that my understanding of how the actual internet works is, even though I'm a technologist and answer questions to people all the time, pretty limited. I always assumed that we had a lot of systems in place that what we call in the computer term redundancy, even though they're actually used. The idea being that anything, any point can has two connections, and if one goes down, the other stays up, and it's all great. And when talking with you, I learned that that's true, I guess, nationally, internationally, but not locally.
Well, it's true for the most part locally as well. There are there's a lot of robustness built into to pretty much any internet architecture, a little less at the edges than there is in the core. But at the edges, there are a few places where there are some single points of failure. Certainly, you know, you look at things like a DSL or a cable connection coming into your house. If you, you know, you go outside and look at it, you've got a one line coming in, and you could certainly cut that, for example. And you'd be off the net.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, let's start from like the person's home out. A phone system, there's a local exchange or like the, what is it called, central office.
Mm-hmm.
So like in a small town, like Aptos probably has one central office. And then each of these little, each like area around this area has an office that's the phone system. And that's where the phone has a giant battery backup power supply thing. It powers your lines, and when you pick up your phone, that dial tone you hear is being generated from that office. Mm-hmm. Is that a good analogy?
It is, yes.
Okay. So the cable company has something similar to that? There's like central offices, and that's where they serve the content, right?
Yeah, usually in the same buildings. There are things called cable head-ins for cable, and there's a thing called a DSLAM for DSL aggregation.
Okay. And the DSLAM, okay, so that's the question. The central office, when my modem makes the DSL call, it's contacting some other modem. Some other modem at the central office, right, to actually terminate that call.
Well, they're not modems per se, but yeah, there are two cards in the central office. It's a sort of a one-to-many connection set of cards, and on the home user end, it's a one box beacon.
Yeah,
it's not really dialing. It's pretty much online all the time.
They right,
some signaling exchange.
Right, I kind of consider it dialing, but it's more like a signal thing. Okay, so in that central office where that DSL aggregator system happens, I always assumed on the other side of that you have some kind of IP network. You get an IP address right there, and there's like right there it's internet protocol. And the reason I kind of assume that, like when we do LAN games or I help out at different businesses, you've got your DSL modem, and then that has an Ethernet port, and you can plug it into a switch, and then you can get something that's producing IP addresses, but basically connect computers, and you're dealing with internet traffic, and we have firewalls, and there's a whole concept. I'm pretty understand that pretty well. So I assume that at that other side of that DSL connection, we had internet access. That's not the case. Something else is going on there, right?
Well, on rare occasion, it is the case where a small DSL provider in a very small region might do it. In a region, they might have a DSLAM and then a router, and you would have IP there.
And that might make sense for a small community where that local place happens to have servers in it. So the school's web server is there. And theoretically, you're not going very much farther away to access the data that's right there.
Perhaps. Much more likely in just a small region that's not well connected to
right,
any other small regions. DSL, much like any residential service, is not profitable unless there's high density in a region. So sometimes smaller towns have their own small ISP that starts up with a small DSLAM to service their regional community. But for larger DSL providers like AT&T, for example, they aggregate all of those DSLAMs in lots of regions in a much bigger area using a transport called ATM to backhaul into even more centralized regions before you actually see IP.
Okay, so let's talk about that. So there's a DSLAM box. I mean, is that still the name of it, DSLAM, and then on the other side of that's ATM network?
Generally speaking, yeah.
Okay, so what is that protocol like? Is it how do you talk about it? You talk about it as ATM and it's translating DSL to ATM. Is that a good way of
ATM network? So just like when you think about IP, there are physical lines in the ground that are fiber. ATM are more like a series of switches, maybe in a grid, some kind of a fabric that's connecting lots of DSLAMs, and then on top of that transport are effectively something called virtual circuits that have an A end at the aggregator and a Z end at the DSLAM. But it doesn't necessarily have to take a hard specific path through that ATM network. So if an ATM switch goes down or a link gets cut or something like that, there's a problem. The virtual channel will just move to another switch or take another path. Or if the actual physical circuit gets full, it'll also automatically move virtual circuits around to make sure that...
But it's not IP switching. It's not internet protocol. It's ATM.
Yeah.
Do you know what ATM stands for? Somebody, Google it.
Asynchronous transfer mode. There's Adobe Type Manager. ATM's got so many meanings.
Automatic transit machine, is it?
Yeah.
Automatic teller machine.
Teller machine.
It's a different thing, though.
Yeah, this one, so, they don't get money out of.
So when we had the outage in the Central Coast, actually what happened was a fiber was cut that was carrying ATM.
Well, probably not, actually. If it was just a fiber in between ATM switches, the traffic should have just routed around the ATM network. So it was likely either fiber between aggregated DSLAMs and the ATM network, or fiber in between the edge of the ATM network and the actual aggregate as it turned that into IP. I think in AT&T's network, they're redback switches. But
so you'd have to have some pretty advanced knowledge to know exactly what... I mean, it wasn't just random cuts of fiber. You'd have to really know what you were doing to take things out like that.
Yeah, last week's cuts certainly were not random. They certainly were very targeted. However, they weren't like, you know, global economy or large scale attacks on the internet as a whole. It was a small region. It looks more like a message. You know, this is, we know what we're doing. We're going to cause a little bit of havoc, but you know, it wasn't something that was unrepairable. You know, it was fairly localized.
So one of the things that you told me last week was that it was actually a sonnet ring format. Can you tell us what a sonnet ring is?
Well, there are several different things that were affected in last week's cuts. One of them was there were a few different pieces of transport that go up into San Francisco that mostly impacted people who had MFN above net fiber. And in this particular case, one of the companies I do some work for had a fiber ring that went through that same manhole, and both sides of the ring actually traveled through the same manhole, which was a sad experience, because when you a fiber ring, the idea is that you have a loop of fiber that's taking a completely diverse path, such that if any point you get one side cut, you stay up.
So let's say you got like five different locations. You got a place in San Jose, you got a place in San Francisco, you got a place in Morgan Hill. There's houses there. There's server box, server space, and there's a fiber link. When you draw it, you kind of draw a loop that goes to each city. So each city is connected, or each location is connected to two different other locations. And so you'd assume that if you cut one path, it could go the long way around that circle. That's the kind of idea of it, right?
That's right. I mean, even if you have two locations, you would have two different strands taking a completely different
loop. Yeah,
a
circle
path.
Going. And unfortunately, the physical path was the same of both sides.
In this case, yeah, it did travel through one manhole.
So I would just like to get clear on the... you got the DSL coming to some central office place, and then you got some ATM network that's traveling where? When does my internet connection, like here at the station, when does that become IP? What physical box says, now we're internet protocol?
So in this region, generally speaking, it's all AT&T DSL, sometimes white-labeled resold as other providers.
Mm-hmm. Like Cruzeo does that?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. in AT&T land for this region, I think the aggregation hubs where it becomes IP are in San Francisco, Santa Clara, and there's one other location. But
okay. So when I do if I grab the network right now, which is actually provided by Cruise.io, mm-hmm. And I do a trace route,
mm-hmm.
we'll do a trace route to geekspeak.org. I see my local wireless, no problem. Then I see the actual more secure network that's the IP address that the station has internally. There's a firewall.
Mm-hmm.
And then I see the next one that's actually like a public place is a gateway with an IP address static at cruise.io.com. So, and when I do, if I look at that IP address of that Cruise.io address, I see a Santa Cruz physical location if I do like an internet search. Are you saying that actually box is actually in San Francisco? Do you know?
With Cruise.io, I'm not exactly sure. It might be that that is not a white-labeled AT&T. That might be actually a local DSLAM.
Oh, okay.
And then his upstream might be AT&T.
Which would make sense. Okay. So what you're saying is that it's possible that the phone carrier actually gives a T1 over to Cruise.io's space, and that's how we get IP addresses.
Well, you can resell DSL and then also control the output of the DSLAM and provide your own IP service for it. AT&T has different levels of reselling mm-hmm. DSL where they'll provide the IP or you provide the IP.
Right. But the trick of it is that when you want to connect to the broader internet, you don't actually do that till San Francisco for this region.
Generally speaking, yeah.
Which is pretty incredible to me. That means that one line really is, but ATM is redundant as well. I mean, in the sense that they could have done this circle, this sonnet circle, sonnet ring, could have been in two different physical locations, so it wouldn't have been affected. But I'm assuming there's also other fiber coming into the area. I mean, do the school systems come through that same place too?
There's not a lot of fiber in this particular area. Santa Cruz is hard. You can either pretty much go up Route 1 or over 17. You know, if you look at Comcast, for example, I know they actually go over the mountain, so they have an aggregation hub in Scotts Valley and then in San Jose. But it's pretty easy to become isolated when you're in this particular region, you know,
yeah.
with all the mountains around and the right-of-way.
And that's why the cable service, internet service, didn't go down when this cut happened.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, Comcast stayed up and AT&T DSL went down, but they just happened to get the path that was going down this direction.
Okay, the box up in the room in San Francisco that the general AT&T traffic becomes IP, the internet protocol traffic, where we actually have IP addresses.
Mm-hmm.
What does that look like? What is that box and thing? What, you know, when you look at it, what does it look like? Giant refrigerator?
Is it glowing?
certainly blinking. No, it would be closer to the size of a mini refrigerator with cards aggregating strands of fiber, usually, you know, gig or 10 gig fiber. So it would just look like a metal box with a bunch of yellow fiber strands.
A lot of cable coming out of it.
Coming out of it, yeah.
And it then, it's a, what's it doing at that point? Like, let's say I want to access some IP address in New York, and all of a sudden I come into that box. What happens at that point?
Well, that gets a little harder to explain. I mean, if you've got a destination, you're sending a packet out somewhere. It's forwarding that destination to a router, which is looking up the destination in a table and deciding which interface to send it out.
Right.
You know, it's much like the grid of a road map, where at every junction, you're looking up the destination and saying, how do I know how to get there, and which one of the connections is, you know, the closest next hop.
And is this done by some deciding body? Is this a government agency that controls that first box or all these boxes, or is it more loose than that?
No, it's far, far more loose than that. It's the overwhelming majority is all commercial. Decisions are made by, to some extent, collaboration, to some extent, community consensus. To some extent, you know, my customer paid me to get this done, so we need to throw together something to make this happen.
Some guy named Bob.
About 6,000, well, probably, you know, 500 or 600 people in sort of each of the large regions in the world that really make operational and policy decisions about how the internet works.
Are you one of those people?
I certainly am.
Okay. So when you want to have some service, so you get and you're plugged into the system, how do you say, I mean, let's talk about your business. Of you have a you do a service provide, you're a server co-location kind of thing, right? So you've got a room somewhere with a whole bunch of equipment in it,
mm-hmm.
and you're responsible to make sure that room is connected. And the other week, you lost that connection. So how do you go about dealing with that? What do you have to do to negotiate internet access to your space?
As an ISP, it's a little different than being, say, an end user. There are various different kinds of transports. One is you want to buy service from somebody else. So you might have an upstream transit provider where you're buying a circuit, and then they give you sort of full access to the internet. In other words, they're going to carry redundant paths and access to everything else on the internet. There are things like transport where you might want to connect your sites to each other, where you might have links that, you know, obviously you try to have diverse physical paths to connect to your facilities. And those facilities might also be connected to transit providers and also something called peers, where you're effectively exchanging traffic with other networks of similar size and service.
And in that situation, would if you were accessing machines on those two networks, you wouldn't be going out to a broader space. You'd go right directly between each other.
That's right.
Okay. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The guest today is Aaron Hughes. He's an internet architect. We're kind of talking about how packets actually move around the internet, how regionally separated we actually are in some senses. The geeks in the air room with me are Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe, and Al Luckow. We are taking calls on topic. So if you feel with your questioning you can get more clarity on what's happening, please feel free to give us a call and join the conversation. The numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. Or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. This a router that runs. I used to hear a term May East and May West, and there's like these nodes, and those don't exist anymore. What exists now? I mean, how many large aggregating places are there on the coast, on the California, if you will?
Wow. So yeah, in the United States, there used to be effectively two or three rather large ones, and now there are a lot more. There are basically six major cities where there are lots of competing exchanges. Things like Equinix and Switch and Data have large colocation facilities where lots of carriers come to the same common facilities and interconnect exchange traffic through common switch fabric.
And okay, common switch fabric. So you got AT&T, you got a whole bunch of different telcos, if you will, and mm-hmm. they have their fiber coming into one box, and at this point it's internet protocol, and it's very much like your home switch. But it's just a lot bigger?
Yeah. I mean, to some extent, it is like your home switch. It's everybody's connecting and everybody's exchanging traffic. They choose who they're going to exchange traffic with, and then it flows.
And this is like a PAX system, right? That's one of the...
PAX Palo Alto is one of the switch and data facilities where you can go exchange traffic on a
common
switch.
Okay, so Palo Alto is one of those major cities of internet connect.
Absolutely.
Okay. That box, lots of fiber coming in, maybe some copper as well, mm-hmm. and... let's say you've got one of those fiber lines and you say, I provide these IP addresses to my customers. How do you do that? How do you say, these are my IP addresses?
Well, it's a complicated thing to some extent. It's a lot of it's social, where you go have common meetings and talk to each other and decide if you want to exchange traffic. Sometimes you send out emails to all of these networks and go, hi, I want to exchange traffic with everybody. And they may or may not take you up on it. But it's a negotiation process, sometimes very open, sometimes very complicated, much more complicated for things like, say, Level 3 and Cogent than it is for, you know, regional mom-and-pop shop. In regional mom-and-pop shop, you know, equal size makes it very easy.
Let's do the analogy that we, the five of us in the air room right here, are all representing a whole bunch of customers. Mm-hmm. So Al's going to be AT&T. No, let's make Miles AT&T. He loves AT&T. So Miles is AT&T, and you're your business, and Al and Ben and I are all other companies. Mm-hmm. And we own IP addresses, effectively, right?
Something like that. You represent you're a carrier that represents people with those
IP
assignments.
Addresses.
Yeah.
So each of us has like a book. Of course, it's a database of all the IP addresses that we want.
Mm-hmm.
So Al comes along and Fran, one of his customers, is trying to get to yahoo.com.
Mm-hmm.
So it says it's for the website.
Mm-hmm.
So he comes in and says, and he's already translated what yahoo.com to an IP address. We won't get into DNS. So he now has a number, and that represents where Fran is trying to go.
Mm-hmm.
And Fran has a number. He comes to us and says, what? Hey, everybody know who, you know, this IP address? Who's serving this? Is that kind of what's happening?
Yeah, it's something like that. So if you two are regional-sized players or some medium-sized
yeah.
company, you're both currently paying AT&T as your transit provider to get to Yahoo.
Okay.
For example, or Level 3 or UNet or something like that. And
so kind of effectively, Miles or AT&T has everybody. All the traffic goes through him.
Right.
So what about your box sitting there servicing some cool website like geekspeak.org, and it's a server in your room? that IP address is you. Does it go? Does Al talk to AT&T and the AT&T comes back and goes to you, or is it more direct?
Until you get to peering, yeah, that's exactly what happens. It goes to the large transit providers and then goes back down to the you know the medium sized players. But you could feasibly go to Yahoo and say, "Hey, we're paying for a lot of traffic going over AT&T level 3 unit, whatever. We'd like to exchange traffic directly.
Oh.
We are located in PAX Palo Alto or Equinix Ashburn or you know something like that. Can we exchange traffic over one of these switches?" And you get an email back saying, "Sure, let's set up a session and exchange traffic."
So then you're going to rechange your protocols instead, or Al's going to change his protocols for Fran, and Al's going to be now being saying, "I'm not going to talk to Miles. I'm just going to ignore him. I'm going to talk to you, you directly."
That's right.
Directly. And that would happen because now his lookup tables for IPs wouldn't go through AT&T. It would go directly to you.
He'd have both paths available, and
right.
he would take the shorter
would take
one.
A different one.
He would prefer his peers, yeah.
So he's responsible for managing that.
That's right.
His switch is smart enough now. For his, when Fran comes up and lasts for something, it's going to go, "Ooh, I'd really like to go through Aaron. I'll have to go through Miles if I can't." Wow, that's pretty interesting. So that's kind of how the structure that I always kind of understood. I guess the level of complication is that's at a very high level. Like the PAX Palo Alto, you said, is like 500 people that get involved in that negotiation. That's pretty small for the entire area that it serves.
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at each of those large peering fabrics and assume that they are, generally speaking, larger companies exchanging larger amounts of traffic. You're not going to be a small regional ISP and go to one of those locations because it's not cost-effective. It's much more cost-effective to buy from a few upstream transit providers and let them handle that.
Right, right. All right, geeks, how are you feeling about what Aaron's telling us? Are we clear? Is there anything that's complicated, confusing?
Well, it's all confusing.
It is.
But it seems like somebody knows what's going on. I mean, I have a question that's DSL-related that...
Okay.
Yeah, I think Aaron could probably tell me. You know, a lot of times you get DSL and people say, "Well, you're too far from the switching station. You can't get it, or it's not going to be as fast." Can you tell me how that relationship works and what's the distance? You know,
yeah.
Exactly. How, you know, why is it that some people get faster DSL, others don't get as fast, or some people can't get DSL? How does that work?
So, you know, the technology continues to change, right? So over time, the speeds you can get over a certain amount of distance on copper are increasing.
So maybe something that you were told a year ago or 2 years ago about your DSL service may no longer be true. Maybe things have, you know, man has advanced.
Well, in this region, again, it's a little difficult. So there's not more central office growth in this region. We have a few central offices. Your home or your business is staying the same distance away unless we have a nice big earthquake and you get pushed a little closer.
Oh, yeah.
but as it stands today, that distance is fairly static. So if you were told you couldn't get a certain level of DSL, it is just simply because of the limitations of the distance of copper that you can travel with the technology that DSL.
So how close does I mean, is it some sort of switching station or some sort of like golden glowing refrigerator that is the thing that DSL that I have to get close to in order to read it? How does that?
It is the
is it a mile away or glowing. Like 10 miles away or is that be next door?
It depends on the type of service, but you know, generally speaking. You're looking at a few thousand feet of line for getting any service, and the closer you are, the better you are.
Mm-hmm.
That big glowing machine has a card in it that is talking to the motor in your house, and that pair of copper can only be so long for...
So a few thousand... If you're not within a few thousand feet of one of these magical stations, then you're probably going to not be able to get something like DSL or...
That's right. And a cable does not have the same limitations. So,
so cable, on the other hand, if you have cable coming into your house, as in a cable modem, you know, it's the same modem as it's the same as your cable TV. Then, or I mean, we're saying cable. Is it cable internet or cable TV, or is it one and the same?
It is the same kind of coax. There are different signalings that split mm-hmm. what's going over that coax. And one of those things you can signal is to separate.
And so, you know. And so cable just doesn't have that few thousand feet limitation. You could have cable coming into your house, and then you say, "Oh, well, I can't get DSL, but I can get cable connection." And the cable is just as fast or faster or...
Well, you know, not representending anybody's opinion, but my own. Cable's a lot faster. It doesn't have anywhere close to the limitations of DSL.
And it can go longer distances.
Yeah.
People used to say that cable, you know, if a lot of people had cable modems in your neighborhood, it would slow down your whole... is that true still?
It's the same with DSL or anything else. So this is a one-to-many service. So if you look at, for example, like imagine if you take a tree and sort of turn it upside down, you got the trunk at one end, you got a whole bunch of branches, and then you have more branches and leaves on the very end. You know, those are all being aggregated back up into some larger pipe. And the more people you have using the traffic on the edges, of course, the more you're filling up that aggregation trunk at the end. So, you know, if you've got a neighborhood and there's a certain amount of bandwidth available and you've got a few hundred connections and more people are using it around you, of course, there's going to be more congestion towards those edges. And providers pay attention to that, and they do upgrade those paths.
So really, the thoughts that I had about cable being not as good because of that reason are... there's no difference between cable and DSL. I mean, everybody has that same problem. So really,
I assumed, Aaron, that the issue with cable was that a local community on one, everybody's sharing the same pair of copper, right? The shield and the center core. The cable is actually just one thing. Isn't that true? Like down my street, aren't all my neighbors using the same pair?
No.
Okay, so we all each, because I look at a cable line that taps to the house. There's like a box and a line inside. There's actually multiple lines.
Yeah. So in some cases there are. So there's a balance between level of service and profit and loss, right?
Right.
So trunks will be brought in, lines will be split for the given level of service.
Right.
So if you go to the outside of an apartment and you see a couple of large cables coming in and it's split off into a box of a whole bunch of cable, if that's just video, that's probably the case.
Right.
As it starts to become more and more internet service, they do bring in more trunks. They do split less. If you purchase, say, a business class level of that, sometimes they bring you in a dedicated trunk just for you.
I want to keep talking with you, and let's do that at lunch because we're out of time on GeekSpeak.
I think I learned something today.
I did too. GeekSpeak on KSP is supported by a grant by Great Infusions Coffee Beanery and Espresso Machinery Showroom, offering artisan coffees, coffee makers, and specializing in home espresso machines, parts, and repairs. Located at 317
Potrero Street
on the corner of River Street in Santa Cruz, or online at www.greatinfusions.com. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The geeks today were Ben Jaffe, Al Luckow, and Miles Elam. Thanks, guys.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Lyle.
My name is Lyle Troxell. Our guest today is Aaron Hughes. He's an internet architect. Aaron, thank you so much for being here today with us.
Thank you.
I was wondering, we have a really dynamic and live forums, and I'm assuming some listeners will actually ask us more questions about this. Do you mind if I pester you on more questions about these things?
Not at all.
That's wonderful. And Ben, you've been doing a really great job on keeping the forums up and live, and thank you so much. It's at our website. There's a forum link at the top, and we answer, and you can ask anything you want, and we answer it. And Ben's been really great about that, and actually Alex as well. I want to thank you guys for doing that. Other geeks in the area who want to participate on helping other people learn about technology and stuff, our forums is a great venue for that. I'd love your participation. Of course, not one geek can handle all the questions that we all get. Except for maybe Miles, but he doesn't have the time.
So he can't.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto, on the web at kosp.org. We have 1 minute left, Ben, and you wanted to rant today, I believe.
Oh, you wanted me to rant.
I do.
I was ranting last night about how much iCal sucks right now.
The application iCal on OS 10.
I love iCal.
It's a great app, but the interface is so bad.
iCal was great.
When it had
it
a,
was
a
great
drawer.
A year and a half ago when it had a drawer. When you were using Tiger, iCal was great. And then they moved to this weird pop-up window interface, and
it loses focus. It's hard to remember where you are. Your times, the alert entries that you always use, it always changes.
It's not clean. It's not like an Apple application anymore.
I know, totally. Yeah. Aaron, you use a Mac?
I do.
Wow. I wouldn't expect that.
Yeah, network engineer, you
Macs
think.
Are everywhere.
PC. Oh, yeah.
Well, thank you, geeks, for being here. Coming up next is Car Talk, so stay tuned for that. For KOSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell.